Niels Bohr Institute in Denmark, and he will enlighten us on spectral triples in quantum gravity.
Thanks, Mark, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk here. So this is a joint work with Johan Ostrup, who's sitting here, and Richard Nis, and as you said, it's spectral triples in quantum gravity. It's a little bit off, but okay, so it's only the C. So the content of this talk is, first I want to talk a little bit about motivation. Non-commutative geometry. So I mentioned spectral triples, and particularly I mentioned this, the cons from nature and the standard model of cosmic gravity. This work is particularly very nice in this framework. So it's a single gravitational formulation of the standard model of cosmic gravity. However, it is at its core, essentially, it's classical. So the question we raise is, what about quantization? How does quantization fit into this framework? And that's basically the work that's talking. So our aim is to formulate a model which combines elements of non-commutative geometry and quantum field theory. And here we have taken our inspiration in loop quantum gravity. And the construction, which I will tell you about, is a spectral triple, which is a kind of the basic element of non-commutative geometry that kind of lives over a space of A of connections, where the here B is an algebra of loops, so there are functions over A. D is a Dirac type operator over this space, the function space. So it's kind of a function derivation. And this is a separate Hilbert space of states over A. The interaction between the Dirac operator and B will reproduce the Poisson structure of general relativity. And I'll also, and the technical part of this is, so the construction is based on a projectable, countable system of graphs. So there's a lot of this which comes from finally, I'll talk about the Hamiltonian. I will show how one can perhaps understand the Hamiltonian constraint of general relativity within this framework. And particularly, D squared or something similar to D squared looks a lot like that. But first, non-commutative geometry. So a spectral triple is a collection of three elements, where we have a star algebra, B representing its operators on the Hilbert space, we have a self-adjoint unbounded Dirac D, with compact and solvent, and acting on the Hilbert space, and then we must have the commutator with D, and the element of the algebra is bounded. And then Kant has put forward a set of axioms that such a spectral triple should satisfy to be a really non-commutative geometry. But at the moment, we are just interested in spectral triples. This setup, if the algebra is commutative, then this is equivalent to just Riemannian spin geometry. So here, the algebra would just be this algebra of smooth functions.
So the commutator between the Dirac operator and any operator in B. It's just like the joint action. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, just derivation.
So it is okay. So there's a representation of this Dirac operator on the algebra of operators too.
Yeah. So this is acting on the Hilbert space.
D is an operator in the Hilbert space, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it also acts on the algebra.
You have an algebra in the Hilbert space, and you have D, so you can commute the elements.
Yeah.
They're both operators. So you can just commute them.
So that means D will commute with anything in B.
No.
That's what I'm confused about. Will not in general, but I mean in the commutative case, will it commute?
No, D is unbounded.
D is between you and me is del slash.
Yeah, D slash.
D slash.
That's kind of just
the
differential.
But D doesn't belong to B. That's the thing.
That's my point. It can't belong to B, or else it'd have to commute in that case.
It's unbound.
Yeah, it doesn't belong to
D. It doesn't belong to D as the right operator in the commutative case.
And is it a Dirac operator with A in it? Is it A dependent? So it's a connection to a Dirac operator.
Yeah. So a particular example of, okay, so this thing is for commutative Dirac. set this. But generalized is very natural to non-commutative algebras. And that's the interesting part. Because here, and I'm not going into many details, but here the standard model of particle physics fits particularly nice into this framework. So here you have algebraized as smooth functions and then for the tensor with a certain matrix algebra where you have complex numbers, two complex quaternions, that's three plus three. And then the Dirac operator is just, it has two parts, one x and one each section. Yeah. And the Hilbert space is a fermionic content of the standard model. Then, if you write down a quantity that depends only on the spectrum of this Dirac operator, here I should say that we have to take into account certain so-called fluctuations of the Dirac operator. It's just like you add something because this Dirac operator is not invariant from the unitary transformation. So if you write down the so-called spectral action and make an expansion, to this is just some product function, make an expansion, this is a scale parameter, then you get out the classical action of the standard model coupled to gravity in this vertical expansion. And again, so in this framework, if we instead have just a commutative algebra, then this is just going to lead to that such equal this part. So the point, and this is I just want to point out that the essential thing to see is that this formulation really formulates the standard model of coupled to gravity as a single gravitational point. And it does this by modifying space time, or the function of over space time, with just a matrix factor here.
Oh, wait, is gravity dynamical in this?
Yeah, it's
dynamical in the Dirac operator that contains all the gravity.
Yeah, but are you sort of integrating out over different Dirac operators? I mean, if you were to do a path integral of gravity.
No. I just very briefly reading your concept.
I know, but in that.
So this is not a part of it. This is classical.
I know it's classical, but I'm asking if gravity is dynamic or not.
Are they different?
Are there Einstein equations?
Yeah. It's totally equivalent to.
So they're different Dirac operators? Different parts of the Dirac
operator?
Yeah.
It's just, there's not a single Dirac operator.
No, you choose one, take one,
yes.
Et cetera, et cetera.
So but how do you know what are all the possible Dirac?
If you go back two slides, you had a dm there, which was the Dirac operator over the base manifold.
Yeah.
Presumably that has spin connection.
Yeah, exactly.
As the connection.
Yeah. So this is D slash basically. Absolutely.
But what are your dynamical variables? That's really the question.
It's the spin connection that's in that PM.
Yeah, and then also these guys here. So this fluctuation generates the bosonic part of the standard
model. But I know you limit yourself to algebras which are the algebra on a particular manifold, and you vary the Dirac operator to an arbitrary operator, or just the operators that come from connection, from metrics on the manifold.
It comes from metric.
You demand it to come from a metric on the manifold.
Yeah, that's
And also, what is this psi mean?
Okay, so this is just some element in the ego space. So this part here just gives the fermionic part of the center model, and this part gives the bosonic part.
What are the dynamics? You said
so this is dynamic, the action. Yeah, so the fermions, the dynamic nuclear field, the bosons here, and the connection. Okay, so the question that we ask is, if the standard model translates nicely.
Also, one of the, in the past, it used to be always Riemannian of signature.
Yes.
It could not be.
Yeah, it is.
Lorentzian, is that?
No, it's going to be. This is, yeah, it's true. It's true. Thanks. So what we want to say is here, if the standard model fits so nicely into the framework of non-commutative geometry as a gravitational theory, well, how does the quantization procedure itself translate into this language of non-commutative geometry? Is there some kind of translation as well? And because it's basically this formulation, it's basically a gravitational theory. So the standard model just comes at by this kind of fluctuation. a basic experiment. So it seems that if you want to translate quantization procedure into this framework, we would somehow involve concurrence. And the second question is, well, how do you explain this modification here? That's another question.
So I'm just certain. I have some of Raphael keeps asking all my questions.
But
well, with me, you never know. But so I'm just this B sub F. I mean, what I understand this to mean, I have some manifold C infinity M that ordinarily would be what I use if I do pure gravity, right?
Okay.
So what you're saying in this thing is at every point I have this additional algebra B sub F, and the standard model is embedded by some method in that B sub F, basically, right? All the stuff in the standard model. So in some sense, it's not unified. It's still basically a direct product structure.
This is true, but it fits remarkably well into the. I can't go into details now, but it's for example, heat exchanger comes out beautifully, and hydrocharges come out very nicely. So it's more than just a product. There's a lot of stuff. But of course, it's true. You have this. Of course, is not arbitrary. It's fitted to the standard model.
Yeah, so if we discover new particles at the LHC, then that BF has got to be changed, presumably, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Okay.
So if LHC flops, you're happy. If LHC succeeds, you're miserable, roughly speaking.
Yeah, okay. So they
they've always tend to.
I'm just trying to call a spade a spade. That's all. I'm just trying. Okay, so the BF is tailored to the particle physics structure.
Totally
model.
Yeah,
that's
totally
that's
correct.
Basically
totally
right.
Yeah, yeah, totally correct. Yeah,
so weren't there claims that there were some predictions coming out from Higgs or something like
that? Yeah,
there
is predictions.
So it could actually be confirmed.
Yeah, 110%.
Or it could be, even if they found the Higgs, it could come out wrong.
Higgs, yeah, no, there is a prediction on the Higgs mass.
So does that mean the prediction of Higgs mass, but not of the Higgs existing?
The Higgs must exist.
The Higgs,
that's the whole point.
So the Higgs is put in there, but the machinery outputs
the
value for the mass.
No, the Higgs is an output. So these fluctuations, the form of these fluctuations, it's an output. It's not something you put in, it's something that comes out when you consider unitary fluctuations of the geometric. And so this is a so-called one form in the framework of non-commutative geometry. And exactly, it's exactly the matrix factor that generates the Higgs fields and potential. So the Higgs is an output. So the Higgs is so totally essential.
So what's input? Because I would regard by definition Higgs as input to the standard model, not as output. So that's
sorry,
what I mean. My definition, no, faster.
Yes, I am.
Okay, so we have questions now?
So this is input. It's a spatial triple. Let's see. So we have the
yeah, but you had to tell me what B sub F was, right?
Yeah, sure.
I mean,
sorry.
What I'm trying to, like, if I heard the standard model, it's got.
This is basically the input. And then the input here is a form of this parameter 2, that degrees of freedom.
So you need input of 6 quarks and 6 leptons,
yeah,
right?
They come here. But
and you need get the W, Zs, photon, and gluons, right?
Once you have said this, you get the bosonic set.
Oh.
They come out as some
okay.
These inner fluctuations. Here.
All right, I'll take your word for that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm
so you input the fermion sector, and then the bosonic sector is forced on you. Is that the idea?
The fermion sector is not completely free either, because if you take this algebra and you consider kind of representations of this algebra, the fermion content of standard model turns out to be, in a sense, canonical for this algebra. That's in the Kahn's last wave.
So if I
you have to check it on the paper.
So if I played with that algebra and made it something else, I would get a different fermionic content that I would output and a different bosonic content that would be output.
This is true.
Okay, all right, that's
correct. This is great, but this is true. I mean, the Higgs is kind of the when you see how the Higgs mechanism comes out of this framework, you see that the Higgs is somehow the okay, so I get to So the question was, believe me, I read the papers, this framework of non-commutative geometry somehow fits remarkably well to the standard model. But it's classical. So we want to see how does the conversation procedure fit in with it. And so the goal is to construct the first some kind of model that combines elements of non-commutative geometry with elements of quantum gravity. And here we're taking a lot of ideas from you.
By the way, does it make a prediction on supersymmetric partners or anything? No. It says that there will not be any.
What does?
There's no Susie.
Is there any Susie?
The
no, it just, yeah, yeah.
In this thing, there's no supersymmetry, right?
No.
It's allergic to supersymmetry.
It's the photonic sector and ferromagnetic sector fundamentally different. So, in my opinion, supersymmetry is not very natural. But of course, it could sit. So the loop quantum gravity, I'm not saying much about since I think in this place there was a lot about that, but I just mentioned so we have foliation and a string of variables, a condition two connection, and a triad field. And then we have the Poisson brackets between these fields and constraints, of course. For the loop quantum gravity, once you focus from connection to anomalies and then flux of the so we had a surface, and this. And integrate the triad over the surface. And then you calculate U cosines brackets and what the flux variable does when you have a surface here, you have a curve that cuts through the surface, where it just inserts a generator SU2 into that line. Then the algebra of holonomy loops in loop quantum gravity is handled through. An inductive system of piecewise analytic graphs. So you cut it down first to consider the space of connections from the point of view of the graph. And then you increase the complexity of these graphs infinitely. So for example, if we have a space of smooth connections with some compact state base group G, then we can denote by A gamma here the restriction of A to a finite graph. And then seen from this graph, a connection is just a point in the n copies of E, because each element of E is just a parallel transport along the edge, where n here is in the number of edges. So that means that seen from a finite graph here, the space of connections is simply a manifold, it's just n copies of E. So this gives us a predictive system, of course, in the spaces of connections. When we increase the graphs, and we just get higher, more and more refined versions of this functional space. And between them, then we have structure maps, so just predictions between groups. So for example, here we have this prediction as circuit before, so we just number it 1, 2, 3, 4, and then the prediction the other way, just multiplies 1 and 3 because that's these two here and this two here. And the result is that when you take the limit of this, then the space of connections is sitting densely inside the limit. And that's somehow the starting point of I think loop quantum gravity because the problem manifold structure, I put a little A up here, A bar, normally it's just been A bar, A for analytics, so there'll be another A bar there. And the problem for structure of this A bar permits a lot of structure, so you can, there's a step level observation of the hyperspace structure, gives a kinetic hyperspace, and then you can represent operators. And what we want to do is we want to construct a spectral triple, so that means we want to have an algebra to wrap up the hyperspace satisfying these conditions. That when the algebra should involve this loop algebra, or algebra of loops, because an algebra is a loop is just something that has a connection into a matrix. And then we want, as I said earlier, one of the interaction between the Dirac operator and the algebra of loops to reproduce the Poisson structure. And the strategy we have is exactly to explore this problem in the structure of A, what's the space of connection.
I think it's important that you say here that this is not the Dirac operator on space, it's the Dirac operator on the It's based on the connection. So
yeah. We basically now forget about manifolds. We just have an abstract space of connections. Mm-hmm. Functions. This is true. So the first step in this strategy is to construct a spatial triple at the level of each finite graph. So this is not difficult because at each finite graph, then the spatial connections here is just a copy of G. Each copy of G will represent the parallel transport. So it's easy to construct a spatial triple here because we have the Haar measure. You can just write down the parameters. It's just a manifold. Next step is to ensure that.
Wait a minute. You have a to write the Dirac operator, you need something like a metric.
Yeah.
So you have to have.
This is just a strategy. I'll get into detail.
Also, in a general way, at least it would help me. You said you want this to reproduce the Poisson structure. Can you explain how does the Dirac operator yield the Poisson structure?
I'll get to that. I just kind
of. Oh, I thought you had showed it to us already.
No. This is just giving the strategy. I was going to detail it later. Details on how we do this. So this is just to have kind of a strategy in mind. You know, we start with a finite. And then the next thing is we want to increase the complexity of the graph. So that means we want to have ensure compatibility with the structure maps between graphs, these projection maps. Okay. So there are projection maps between these. You know, when you increase the graph, you'll be more complex with G. And then there are projection maps between these function spaces. And that means there'll be maps, induced maps between Hilbert spaces. And then if I have a Dirac operator, for example, it shouldn't matter if I evaluate the Dirac operator on a Hilbert space. Or if I lift up a certain level, or I lift it up to a higher level, and then work with the Dirac operator. Mm-hmm. I'll come back to this later as well. And then the third part is just to take the projective limits of this thing, just to make this be infinite complex. So just let the graphs go infinite, just like that. We tried this in a couple of years ago, and we failed, but mostly because the problem we find is that if you just take arbitrary graphs, like piecewise analytic graphs, then there are way too many different kind of embeddings between the different kinds of structure maps. And it's very hard to have a Dirac operator operating in this system of graphs. And of course, the setup is all accountable. That was a bit of a problem, too.
What does overcountable mean exactly?
Uncountable?
So each graph is countable, but the overcountable means piecewise.
Uncountable in English.
Greater than
L is zero.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's uncountable.
Uncountable.
Yeah.
Uncountable.
Okay. Overcountable
is when you check the log twice. Uncountable is when you run out of money.
So if you count it too much, you know. Okay. You can't count this. It's too big. Anyway, so what we have done now is we try again. And look, taking the lesson from these papers, we consider now a restricted and countable system of graphs. Something pretty simple. We cut down the type of graphs radically. So in these two papers, we just took a triangulation, G, but you can also think of it as abstract simplicity complex, just some combinatorial structure. And then we consider barycentric subdivisions as our refinement of graphs. When we make it more and more complicated, we just take this one way of refining. And this turns out to be a workable idea. And in this talk, I will just make it even more simple. I'll just take a lattice and then just refine the lattice just by dividing each cell into. So this is a two dimensions, but of course, the three dimensions just divided into cells.
But in principle, you could take any subdivision and keep taking barycentric subdivisions of them.
Yeah, you just need to do the same thing every time.
Yeah.
If there are too many different things, it kind of screws up the Dirac operator.
But this is it independent of whether you do triangulation or squares or hexes or whatever? Or you don't know yet?
Well, you did it for triangulation. Yeah, and if it works here, it works. I mean, then we have a.
So it works there and it works in the bottom, so that's at least positive.
No, no, I mean, we have some requirements for what type of graphs works. But you can do as anything. It just has to be, I mean, it doesn't have to have the same kind of subdivision every time. It has to be countable.
Do you get the same thing in the end if you do different trying and
yeah,
tessellation?
I mean.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, you can use two at least.
Yeah, yes, depends on what level. It's all
oh, okay.
The algebra is going to be different because there somehow, I mean, the lattice is differently connected than trying to use. So, I mean, the difference is not big.
Mm-hmm.
The difference would be in the remaining symmetry, it's not compact. So there is a difference, but.
So it's never coincide. I mean, you can't, by making enough subdivisions of this and subdivisions of this, you can't ever arrive to the same.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah, of course. The point is, of course, when I do this infinitely many times, I can approximate any loop I have by such a graph because it stays.
Yeah, but I mean,
you can do that here, and you can do it here, and you can do it.
But at some finite stage, can you can these two things completely disjoint? Could it happen that it's certain?
Yeah.
You couldn't realize these as a subgraph of these.
That's totally possible. But what we're interested in is the limit.
Right, but if it were true that one of that each of these sat inside one of these, would it prove that you got the same limit? And vice versa, would it prove that you got the same limit in both cases?
Yeah, I mean the hyperspace structure is going to be the same, but it makes a difference for the direct operator. Okay, so now I get to the next thing, what you're doing, your construction. So we just start with a d-dimensional edges, and then we have edges and we have vertices, and the edges are directed so that it should be an arrow from one vertex to another. Then I assign to each edge a group element, so I have a map that assigns to some edge here, a group element. But G is now just some compact E group. And we denote the space of all these such maps by A gamma. And again, we have the A gamma here that's just N copies of G, where N is the number of edges. Because if I have an element in this space here, well, we just let it work in each case, and then we get a point in G. So this is, of course, the same structure. And then the first step now, we want to construct the spectral tube. So first the algebra. So a loop now is a finite sequence here of edges running in this graph, and then we choose a base point. So we take one vertex as a base point, and then we discard through the backtracking. Of course, so if this one ran up here and down, we just throw that away. Of course, there's a holonomy transform with our sequence. Then we have a natural product just by gluing the loops. So if I have two loops and we glue them, then we just glue them at the space points. We have an inversion, so we just inverse the sequence of edges, and each edge we also inverse the direction. So that's an inversion, and that is an inversion. And then we consider formal finite series of loops. So just consider the sums of such elements. And then we can have products between such elements. It's just sort of straightforward. And then also an evolution. It's just the evolution of the loop and then complex communication.
So what is a circle?
Yeah, so the point is these are complex. So I have formal series. So these are complex numbers and this is loops. Mm-hmm. So I just have different products. So this is a product between loops. So if I have a base point here, I have a loop running here.
So this is the loop, the sort of concatenation.
Yeah, I have another loop here, but the product of these two loops is just these two running. That's not. So it's a. And then the evolution is kind of this. And that's a natural norm. We just take the matrix norm. So an element A, such an element here, it says it's norm where this is a matrix norm. Where we take this, then the supremum over this mass here. So this gives us a star divided, it's a C star divided, and then and this would denote by B. That's just a loop rectifier.
But so grad acting on a loop maps it into a what? Group element?
No, that's a connection.
This thing here is a map.
Oh, it's a homonymy.
Yeah, now it's more abstract. So this thing here just maps an H into a group element. But of course, it's
right.
But think of it, it's more abstract because we don't have a manifold yet. So it's.
So grad acting on a loop maps it into a product of G's, basically, the third like the homonymy.
Yeah.
But you're not taking a trace, yet. You're just using
the... No. That's the point. We wanted to have a non-commutative. We took the trace here of the commutative. We want to keep it non-commutative. So it's matrix value. That's the point. Hilbert space. Okay, so we want to represent this algebra on the Hilbert space. So that's a somewhat natural Hilbert space. So we just take the L2 space over incomings of G, where L2 is respect to the harmonic. And then we have the Clifford bundle, and then times the matrix factor here, where L is just the size of the representation of G. And we need these two factors for the Dirac operator and for the algebra. So the loop algebra has a natural representation here. Just if we have a loop here, the loop represents here, I write F here. So it acts on a stage here just by one on the Clifford part, and then just the matrix multiplication on the second part of the matrix. So for example, if I have this loop here, and a number is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, then this loop here that runs 1, 4, 6 inverse, 3 inverse, for example, would act on the matrix part just by matrix multiplication on this thing here. Now I think I have a representation of the.
Besides the matrix, there's a point in the space.
Yeah, I mean, so the Hilbert space here has two factors. So it says functions over functions on the space of incoming and then with values in the Clifford bundle and with matrix factors. Mm-hmm. With matrix factors sitting in the And it's simply because we need the matrix, because the holonomy is somehow the connection here maps from the group and we want to represent. I mean, holonomies are groups, so we want to recommend a matrix actually.
So I was going to ask, I'm confused. So psi, I'm still confused what psi is doing. It's mapping, psi is an element of H, so it should have two arguments, something that depends on.
Psi is an element here, so
yeah.
I want to have, what does
well,
it mean?
Well, forget about that for a minute. It's your question. I want to understand what psi does to the grad operator. It maps. What's
no,
a mapping
so
to where?
Psi of grad is just psi of g1, g2, g3.
Grad is just element in g to the power n.
Yeah.
Okay.
So grad is just now, it's like, you can think of it as, think of it as grad as just coordinate this thing.
So it maps.
No, grad. No.
It's a function of n variables, each of which is a group element. It's not mapping the product of the G's.
The first is correct.
But the first, it's a function of n elements, each of which, n things, each of which is a G.
Yes.
Okay.
You could have started from defining a state which does this, and then through GNS construction, you say, okay, then I have a unique Hilbert space that corresponds to that. Right. So first defining what you call a natural Hilbert space, and then going find out what's the representation. You could have done the converse. You impose that condition, so you have a state that does that, and then you say through the GNS construction from a C star algebra, I have one and only one Hilbert space.
But so then this FL does nothing on the Clifford part,
exactly.
And then it's tensored with the product. of the G's around that loop. But how does that act on the psi?
It acts on this matrix part.
Oh, psi becomes a matrix when it acts on the G's somehow. And then, all right, okay.
All right. So just to prolong this question, I mean, suppose take a particular set of G, little G, particular connection, and a particular psi and acts on the one or the other. I mean, psi acts on psi delta. What's the result exactly? Just what kind of thing is the result?
So what is
this Clifford? It's a whole. Is it a whole field? Is it a point in G sub n together? I mean, it's something in a particular fiber over G sub n. I mean, how could you write out?
Yeah, so you'll have.
What is the CL T star?
So you'll have the. You'll have elements in the G first. So it's an E or something sitting there, and then you'll have some matrix factors sitting around, and there'll be
a. No, but I think Raphael wants to know what. When psi acts on grad, what does the answer look like? Suppose n equals 2. 2 g's will be enough. What psi of g1, g2 looks like what? That's your question.
No, right? It's just for each value of g1 and g2, you get an element in the Clifford function over this point, and you get a matrix factor.
So psi maps G sub n into CL cross n.
That's what the square means. So the functions from.
Okay, it takes functions from GN and maps them into that other thing. Mm-hmm. And then F acts on that thing by triviality on the Clifford and the grad on the other guy. Okay, all right, that's what was getting confused.
But then the map is a special map. In other words, it has to go into that fiber over that point or something. I mean.
Yeah,
it has to go.
But anyway, I mean,
it doesn't consist of all maps from G into this. It's some special subset of. It's a subset of those maps.
Well, it has to be L2.
It's just the L2 sections of the
sections of the
bundle. It takes group elements into Raphael. It takes group elements into that bundle such that they have an L2 norm, right?
But it has to go, the particular group element is taken into something in the fiber over that group element.
Yeah,
that's a restriction.
It's
not all maps. Sorry,
what's
the section? Well, all right.
Yeah, let's say yes per goal.
Yeah, I'm running
okay.
Yeah, so we just.
Okay, so Dirac operator. Well, first on the income is G, we can just choose one. Just choose a matrix on G and just take the UCVs and choose a left, right, and married matrix. And then we obtain a. So this gives us a. On the level of the graph, this gives us a candidate for the matrix. So now we want to. The complexity of this. Well, that's your acceleration of these graphs, not simply the context, of graphs to grow infinitely. And then keep control of these spectral treatments. So we consider now a system of nested matrices, so just like this. And then we have associated these manifolds, these n copies of G. And then we consider the corresponding system of spectral triplets just associated to it. But then we have a condition now that we want a spectral triplet to be compatible with these projections of G. That's what we need. But hyperspace, this is not so, this is doable. The problem is for the Dirac operator, we need to work with it. So it boils down to studying this special case where we have just one edge here, and then we refine it, and cut it in two, and have two copies of G here. So this is a projection just down here from two copies of G to one, just by multiplication. And the compatibility condition is simply that if I let the Dirac operator act up here, if I have an element in the hyperspace down here and then map it up, and the Dirac operator it should be the same as first acting with the Dirac operator down here. And this. So I need to have a consistent family of Dirac operators. And it turns out that this D2, the Dirac operator up here, has a form that there's two parts. There's one that's kind of X and the public key that you lift up, and then there's the orthogonal form that's kind of the free direction. And then you have a free parameter here, so A is just some number for the moment.
Is B what you called psi before? What you calling B now?
Yeah.
And then it's psi.
Yeah. So if we do this repeatedly, so we subdivide repeatedly, then we get, of course, an infinite series of three parameters. And at the level of a given, so we do this just infinitely, at the level of a given graph or given subdivision here, we get a Dirac operator that has this form here. So we just have a connection, some vector fields here. The exact form of these vector fields are quite complicated, so I don't want to show you what it looks like, but it's solvable problem. And we have some parameters and then this element in Clifford bond. So it's just a Dirac operator on n copies of G, but the exact form of the vector fields here is given by this compatibility condition.
And there was some choice of the metric on the group in the game, right?
Yeah, but there are also some restrictions. Yeah.
Is that enough or do you have? How much is that?
Two basic fields.
I'm sorry? Four basic fields?
No, But it's like that. So on the first copy of G, it's three, but when you then go up with the restrictions.
Mm-hmm. So in the limit, when you just take the limit of this, this gives us a candidate for central triple, and the result we have is that this is a so-called semi-final spectral triple. So this means that the resolvent of G is compact up to trace, and the commutator is bounded. So the problem is that you have this huge Clifford bond sitting there, so it's kind of degenerate. So you need to have a trace living there. But it's a technical thing, but basically it does satisfy the requirements of the spectral triple if these three parameters, AN, approach infinity sufficiently fast. So we had these three, so the Dirac operator had the form at least new label, there was a new degree of freedom. You just need to have a coefficient in front of this part of the Dirac operator to grow.
Do you get to choose your AIs?
What?
Do you get to choose your AIs?
Yeah, they're free. For the moment, they're free. I'll return to how we get down to get to that, because there's kind of a natural choice.
Does it have to grow exactly like this, or just at least as fast?
So this is it. This is the requirement. So if you have AN and you take out a factor 2A, and then you just have that B and has to approach infinity.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So it has to approach infinity faster.
Just BNs are just arbitrary coefficients that have to diverge in that limit, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't matter what they are besides that.
Yeah. But I'll come back to this because it is a natural choice. So if I denote now the limit space here, so just we have started with n copies of G, just as a very rough picture of space of connections, and then we refine it with these subdivisions of our graphs, then in the limit, this gives a space which we call A bar triangle. Triangle refers to the triangulation. And so maybe now I should add a box. And in fact, this is a space of generalized connections, which means that the space of smooth connections sits inside there. And to see this, well, first we put our graphs into a manifold, we map somehow into a manifold. And then there's a natural map from the space of smooth connections into this space A by triangle, just by the holonomy. So an element in here is something that science for an H, a group element, well, that's easy now for the connection, just take the parallel transport. So, in fact, this is an embedding, so all of H sits inside here embedding. And to see this, we can just take two different connections, smooth connections, and then they're different on points, so there are different on neighborhood around that point, and then we can just pick some H in some direction, where the holonomy parallel transforms are going to be different. And then these are millions. So that means that this space, the underlying space under the this pro-manifold under our spectral triple, really contains all these connections. So that implies, first of all, that the Dirac operator is kind of a functional derivation of it. So it's a Dirac operator, but it's a Dirac operator of functions. We can say a bit more because it's a global operator. So it has this form here because the Dirac operator does a kind of probes along all edges in this infinite graph. So it has, and because all edges, it's kind of dense in the manifold. So this will be somehow, this is taken heuristically, but it somehow it's a sum over points in the manifold. And then you have some kind of degree of freedom, or shift. This is a shift among each. So the drag of it approaches along each edge and throws it up into a cable ball.
So do the A's sit in this?
So this is just, the A's sit in there, I guess. So far the drag operator has a lot of free parameters. And of course, the inner product in this Hilbert space resembles a function integral, simply because it's an integral over the space of connections. So that was your question.
Nothing so far used that this is a three-dimensional triangle.
It's a d-dimensional lattice. It can be any dimension and any compact. That's true. But it has to be compact. Yeah, I don't know if this is the right way to say it, but I just have to mention too that this Dirac operator is gauge invariant. So if I have a gauge transformation of connections, the Dirac operator. So in loop congruency, there's also a space of generalized connections, as I mentioned earlier, and that's based on piecewise analytic graphs. So now, of course, we have the question, well, we have two different completions in this space of connections. What's the difference? So we have the space of smooth connections, it's basically both inside the A bar A from loop congruity and also in this A bar triangle. Of course, the difference between these completions is the corresponding symmetry groups. Because in loop congruity, you have an action of piecewise analytic isomorphisms, because you talk about piecewise analytic graphs. In this case here, when we have a lattice of triangulations, you have a lot, you have restricted your symmetries enormously. And the remaining symmetries we just call if triangle.
Sorry, what does it mean preserve the graph structure? Of the infinitely dense graph?
Yeah, I mean, if I met some lattice here, well, if you just do it arbitrarily, it's not going to keep the same lattice.
Right.
So
if you take all the subdivisions of that, you want to.
Yeah.
Isn't the identity? I mean, is there anything left? Any different morphisms?
Also depends on what the medical string. I mean, there are something, but not so many problems.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's just some freedom on the boundaries. I mean, because the graph fills the graph.
Yeah, I mean,
that's a very tiny.
It's not
even a one-dimensional.
You can also imagine zooming in.
Since that is constant and small, you get all the translations.
Yeah, it depends on what kind of metaphor you want.
I see some sort of subgroup of the translation group.
But the point is somehow the difference. I mean, you have a lot of these diffeomorphisms.
Okay, sorry. So let's try to do one thing. There are little more than 10 minutes that you have to go all the way to the end of your talk. So unless there are like very crucial questions for the understanding of the flow, let's try to postpone questions at the end.
So I'll maybe I'll speed up a little bit too.
Yeah, you should.
And then you're can ask us. We need to choose there. Because I'm a little bit, I need to go to the
good suggestion.
Yeah. So we observe the following. If you just have the spaces to connections, then we have the full action of diffeomorphism group. We don't have a hyperspace structure, we think. We probably have no derivable. We tried in group congruency setting to construct a Dirac operator and Boucher. The hyperspace structure is there, but it's not separable. And you have analytic diffeomorphisms. In this setting we're working in, there is a Dirac operator. There's a hyperspace structure and it's separable. So the difference between these settings, the choice of completions of these spaces, is just what kind of diffeomorphisms are left. Separability of the hyperspace and the Dirac operator. So it appears somehow that the use of a restricted system of graphs is somehow, you can think of it as a gauge fiction. We have just fixed the diffeomorphism group. An alternative interpretation, well, we can note that a cubic graph is also a piecewise analytic graph. So there's a map from the hyperspace we have into the hyperspace of loop congruency. And in loop congruency, there's also the hyperspace H-diff, diffeomorphism in varying states. So there's a selection and a map from the kinematic hyperspace into the diffeomorphism in varying states. That means that we get a map from our hyperspace into the diffeomorphism in varying hyperspace loop congruency if we choose G to be SU2 and 3 dimensions. So we get a diagram like this where we have these maps. And the amount by which this map from the hyperspace we're working with into the hyperspace of diffeomorphism bearing hyperspace, the amount by which this fails to be an injection is exactly the symmetry group of the remaining diffeomorphisms. So this means that our hyperspace is somehow related to the hyperspace of spatial diffeomorphism bearing state. So what we think about it, maybe you can think about it as a graph or a loop in the zero space or the loop state as a kind of equivalence class of the diffeomorphisms. So I think these ideas have been considered also by financial logics. Okay, so now I want to go back to the Poisson structure. If you take the commutator between our Dirac operator and just one copy of G, then we have just one edge here, so just one copy of G. Then the commutator with our Dirac operator just inserts, we have some Clifford multiplication here, and then it just inserts a generator of the Lie algebra. And this generator is twisted in some sense, but I don't want to go into details. But just think of this as an SU2 generator. Yeah. Of course, if I then take a loop here with more copies of G, I mean more edges, then just a series of commutators. In short, so the action of our Dirac operator here is to insert generators at each vertex. So there'll be, if I have a edge here with the vertices, then the Dirac operator, that's a loop run here, the Dirac operator will insert here, a generator of the Lie algebra. For example, if this is now also a triangle graph, so the commutator with this loop here is just the insertion of certain generators. If I now turn to the Poisson structure I showed previously, it's worked with in loop congruency. So I assume now we do have some operators. This is not our setting, but I assume we have some setting where we have flux operators and some line elements, line operators, that satisfies this algebra here where we insert a generator in the line. Then I can consider, if I now consider such curves here, but just restricted to the graph. So instead of just having any curve, I just restrict cursors that kind of run in this graph. And then I have to do a bit of technicalities because I just have to rewrite up this flux operator in Jumbo or that. Then it's possible to construct a new operator with these guys here, with these flux operators, and add some measure, some Clifford modification to it, and the signs come out of okay, so the point is the algebra here of this operator, commutative algebra, that and the line element, has this form. So it inserts, it has this form, and that's exactly the commutator between the Dirac operator, our Dirac operator, and the line segment. So that means that the interaction between loops and our Dirac operator reproduces the Poisson structure when you restrict the loops to our graphs. But of course you can any loop you can just approximate arbitrarily well in our graphs. So in the limit we get a representation of the Poisson graph here. But it's based on a much more restrictive choice of graphs. And if we recall that the Hilbert space that we're working with corresponds, as I said, to partial solutions of the diffeomorphism constraint, then it seems like we are somehow representing our algebra of loops and Dirac operator on a Hilbert space that already encompasses the constraint, the diffeomorphism constraint. So it's kind of maybe one can think of it not as a Dirac type quantization. When you Dirac type quantize, you first represent a kinematic Hilbert space and then you have constraints, think of the symmetries. This is kind of the other way around. At least that's the way we think about it. So the area operators in loop congruency important, they look like this. And just very briefly, I'll just say that the square of our Dirac operator looks like an as a sum of vertices, it's an area operator, where as each each edge in our graph, we have a little dummy surface sitting there. So somehow it's because the set of vertices extends in our manifold, so it becomes kind of an integral. But becomes a justified integral. And then the integral is here is some kind of area identity operator. So this looks a little bit like an edge. So the square of the graph operator has the form of an integral over the manifold of something which has an interpretation of an area square identity. And this looks like an action. If you then take the spectral action, which looks like this, well then this has a form of Feynman integral. Because it's an integral over the space of connections, or the space of generalized connections. And then we have this thing here which plays a role of an action. Okay, so now I will so far I've only said some yes.
Is A the area has the meaning of area or A squared?
Area.
Which one? A square or A?
So this is an area. So area square.
Oh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so far I've talked about Poisson structure and diffeomorphism constraint, but first there has to be one to talk about gravity, there has to be something about Hamiltonian constraint.
Can you just go back one to the just one?
This is heuristic, but it has.
Yeah. What is that d in the exponents?
This is a.
No, in the exponents.
This?
Yeah. That's the Dirac operator.
Yeah, that's the Dirac operator. Yeah.
So. That d just means. That's an operator, it's not a number. Are you tracing it?
Yeah, yes. So this is a way you find out here. This is very heuristic. I just want to say what is the meaning of this? Yeah, this is a really fine object, but it looks if you think of this as an action, when this then this looks like an integral or a function of something that looks like an action, but it's an operator. True.
Mm-hmm.
we, I mean, we don't, we're just thinking about how can we interpret this thing. Okay, so this algebra is non-commutative, so it will contain the inner automorphisms, so it's next in the algebra that looks like this, where U are unitary elements of the loop. And the Dirac operator is not invariant under such inner automorphisms. But if you want to have it invariant, you must add a part in W, which has this general form here, which is in the terminology of non-commutative geometry, this is a one form. So it's kind of a gauge field, but on this huge space of this functional space. So this is very naturally, and in conscious formulation of Sandemann, this was exactly the mechanism that generated the Poissonic set. Okay. However, gravity doesn't have inner automorphisms. So it's natural somehow to consider a sector where of the hyperspace that doesn't see these inner automorphisms. So we write out a constraint that takes it. We want to have this sector where these fluctuations are not seen, so we write it down like this. And this constraint can be rewritten in terms like this way. So this looks a bit like a field strength tensor. So you have here dW plus W squared. And if I want to see, what does this mean? I mean, what is this constraint here? If I want to have a local classical interpretation of it, what I consider a loop, and some fluctuation here, the first loop I can throw away because I want to have it at the local, so I want to shrink the loop to shift to the limit where it shrinks. And then I write the Dirac operator in terms of the classical fields. So that would be the flux operator, and therefore it's the triad. And I write the loop in terms of the field strength tensor. And then we get heuristically, but I mean, you think about this, so this is D, so this would be the 1D, and then this was the commutator between D and the loop. So this would give another E, so you get 2Ds and F.
Well, where did the E suddenly come from? We didn't have that before.
No, so it's a flux operator. So it's a flux, but the flux is integral over.
Okay.
And, mm-hmm. Yeah. This is a heuristic, but it will always be. I mean, if you want to have a classical expression of this, you need to find a regular classical limit. So, but we just want to find this expression here, which is really fine. What does it correspond to in classical? And it corresponds to this form here, which is exactly which has the form of the Hamilton constraint of general relativity. And then if I look at a sum over such small loops, then I get a new expression here. I look at all small loops sitting at each point. Then I get something that looks like the Hamiltonian. So as I said, this is not quite rigorous. We probably need to add some more structure to get that out. But the general structure is somehow there. So the remark I want to make is that this expression is canonical. I mean, once you have the Dirac operator, it's somehow, this is what you want to have. This is natural. It's free of ordering ambiguities and it requires no regularization. And of course, the full system has enough morphisms, which means there will be some additional degree of freedom. And so it's only when you kind of turn off these enough morphisms that we obtain the structure of the Hamiltonian constraint. And then, of course, we'll think about this operator here, or perhaps only this part here is a Hamiltonian. And that means that we have a time evolution operator. If it's this one here, well, then time evolution will kind of vanish when you have the sector of pure gravity. Okay, I will skip this part here. So this is just the meaning of the sequence A. But I mentioned that it's a natural choice because the A's are related to what happens when you have H and you split down. So therefore the natural choice is just to choose this should be a plus here. So just A n that's 2 to the power of A. But this is exactly where this Dirac operator fails to be stable. But then we could try and set just 2 plus x, and then take the limit here. There would be some kind of regularization scheme. That's quite natural in this framework. Okay, let me just go to the conclusion. So we have constructed a semi-finite spectral tree, where this is an algebra of Polynomial groups or loops. D resembles a function, global function duration operator. And the Hilbert space corresponds up to a discrete symmetry group to the Hilbert space of spatial diffeomorphic covariance states. And the interaction between the algebra and the Dirac operator occurs in the cell structure here. And then we find that the structure of the Hamiltonian from general relativity does emerge from the condition which restricts to a sector where you have no inhomes more. And yes, maybe just mention that when you have a spectral triplet, you have a non-cubic geometry, that means you do have distance. In this case, our spectral triplet defines the distance between geometries, between field configurations. So two different connections have a distance, so when you find distance in these Dirac operators. And I think I'll just finish. Yes.
Yeah, 5 minutes for questions and Rachel.
Is this distance the distance between diffeomorphisms and invariant classes of geometries arbitrary?
Yeah, one could think about it like that. The interesting thing I think with the distance is that if you have two field configurations that differ at very large scales, then the distance will be large. If they differ at very small scales, they will be close. So it's kind of a scale dependent distance.
If I have two metrics, I don't know what to call these things, connections, anyway, geometries of one and I perform a diffeomorphism on geometries of two, but not on geometries of one. Will the distance be changed?
If you keep one and move the other one, it will be changed.
Yeah, so it's not, in that sense, it's a diffeomorphism. It's a distance not between geometries.
Between predictions.
Sometimes people use the word geometry to mean diffeomorphism class of metrics.
Yeah,
so when you're comparing two metrics, that's a diffeomorphism tree and how they compare.
Precise, it's a distance between connections. That's the thing. But then you can think about the USB connection.
I'm making a different point.
Yeah.
But you would think in a diffeomorphism in invariant theory, the natural distance would be between geometries, which are diffeomorphism equivalents, classes of metrics.
There's not distance between geometries. I should distinguish. Depends on the local structure, the coordinate you choose.
It depends on the coordinate,
yeah,
that's
so,
right.
Yes.
So it's a distance between metrics, more or less, as opposed to the distance between geometries and in that
okay.
Terrain.
So you interpreted the square of the Dirac operator as a kind of action. Do you have any intuitive idea of what kind of continuous action that would correspond? It would be something that only depends on the connection, right?
It's a fact, I think, that the square of the Dirac operator has the form of an integral of many something.
Mm-hmm. But are there any techniques to get some?
No.
Okay. And the other question, do you have any physical understanding of what these fluctuations W are? What is that?
I think you didn't. I think that would be quite interesting because but of course all this. I mean, we can kind of. Some, I mean, the goal is.
It has nothing to do with different ones, right? I mean, what's
But there is something more that's somehow the idea. We start with pure gravity because it's not everybody knows gravity. We get more out of things. That is what we are hoping. That's what the motivation is. And
that's there. What it exactly is, we don't know. But I think also to really see that you have to have a classical memory. You don't have a classical memory to compute. So all we have is kind of hand waving. I mean, we don't have a central trip. What it means at the moment, kind of hand waving. We need to, for example, we would like to compute spectral X. It exists as a mathematical object. It's well defined, but we haven't computed. So we know roughly, kind of, we have an interpretation of it, but we don't know what it is.
Just out of interest, Kant's model used to have a problem with machine masses. Is that the problem?
That is.
That's by giving and just by giving this file this one has says to have use cage and change that was
I think that was last yes.
All right, very good. So let's thank our speakers again.